My name is Rosie Abella, and I've been a student of Rod McDonald's ever since I came here to teach in 1988. Over the next 5 years, teaching a different course every year, I came to see that in bringing me to McGill, I was part of Rod's plan called Educating Rosie. My first class was Advanced Administrative Law. I guess Rod thought that since I was chairing an administrative tribunal, I might as well learn some administrative law. And as every person knows, teaching is the best way to learn. The next year, he asked me to teach a class on advanced jurisprudence. He was going to be co-teaching with me. I was a little nervous. I'd never taken a course in jurisprudence, let alone taught one. But I had been a judge for 13 years at that time. So I thought I had at least some sense of what jurisprudence was about. I was wrong. That first class, Rod and I sat at the head of a long seminar table around which sat about 20 third-year students. His opening words were, "How do you know this is a table?" Not, "Hi, welcome to the class. I'm going to be teaching this class with Rosie Abella." Nothing. Just, "How do you know this is a table?" And for the next 2 hours, I watched as Rod and the students debated how they knew it was a table. And as I recall, my own philosophical contributions were along the lines of, "Are you kidding me?" "But it looks like a table." Or the philosophically unanswerable, "Isn't this what tables are supposed to look like?" I was pathetic. And it reminded me of my first year in university where people said you have to take Marcus Long's philosophy class. And I went with my best friend, Sharon, and he said at the beginning of the class, "If a tree falls in a forest and there is nobody there to hear it, does it still make a noise?" And I turned to Sharon and I said, "I'm out of here. Who cares?" So when the class ended, I said to Rod, "I took your course because I thought I was entering McDonald land. I was going to learn how to use multisyllabic, incomprehensible words like epistemological, instrumentalism, deontological, polycentrism, not table." "I don't think this is for me. I've been a judge for a lot of years, and this isn't what we do. Who owns a table? Maybe. But why is it a table? Never." "Don't give up," he said. "Next class." "We're going to start with the readings, and it'll all come together for you." Well, it did. So we started our journey through Christopher Stone's Law, Language, and Ethics with that classic Broad Kafka metaphor, and I started my journey into understanding what a judge was after 13 years of being one. More importantly, I came to understand the why of judging. By reading and discussing wonderful judgments, terrible judgments, progressive philosophers, restrictive ones, I came to sort out my own philosophy. And it was through Rod's legal imagination, including his imagination that had academic potential insight for non-academics like me, he unbound not only how I imagined law, but how I imagined myself in the law. He taught me that justice is the aspirational application of law to life, that the status quo is only the beginning of the inquiry, that law and the public interest should have a good working relationship, and that virtue and fairness are law's biological parents. He also showed me how the legal imagination takes off from many legal runways, the ones traveling to public law, to private law, to legal systems generally, and to legal education in particular. And underlying this magnetic gift that Rod has of opening our minds to imagining new ways of thinking and our hearts to understanding why we should, is his sheer decency. This man is many things for which we should be grateful. But above all, what we cherish is that he's a mensch, a good man, a preternaturally brilliant, prolific, and inspiring one, but a mensch all the same, a man of virtue, a teacher of virtue, and a friend of virtue. All this plus the world's best family. How lucky McGill is to have him in its midst, and how lucky the rest of us are that it shares him with us so generously. Thank you, Rod, for all you've done, all you do, and all you will do. Thank you. You can also blame him for my obsessive compulsion with standards of review, as any student of it. Correctness? What? Why aren't they deferring? So that brings me to our closing panel on pursuing virtue. These remarkable panelists, almost all former colleagues of mine from the time I was here at the law school, except for David Sandomirsky, who wasn't even born yet, are the best and the brightest that our profession has to offer. David was Beverly McLaughlin's clerk at the Supreme Court, where I met him after he graduated from McGill and had been the editor-in-chief of the Law Review, and is now getting his PhD from the other law school I love, the University of Toronto. Stephen Toop is the legal juggernaut who went from dean here at McGill to founding president of the Trudeau Foundation, to president of UBC, and now to incoming president of the Monk Center. Alison Harbison-Young taught here for over a decade, became dean at Queen's, and is now one of the most respected jurists on the Ontario Supreme Court. Blaine Baker has taught at McGill for 30 years, including as associate dean, is Canada's iconic legal historian, and is now professor emeritus at McGill. And finally, the real convener of this panel, who graciously made way for my participation, is Jeremy Weber, former dean at the University of Sydney Law School, former professor here, current dean at University of Victoria Law School, and co-author, as I told him last night, of groundbreaking articles in a number of areas that have influenced so many of us. So, Jeremy.
Thanks very much. I share the immense debt of gratitude to Rod that many have expressed here. That debt is owed not merely to his papers, two of the very best of which are represented in this panel, Office Politics and Legal Bilingualism, but also, perhaps even more, to his practice. I've learned so much and continue to learn so much from his practice, especially from his continual demonstration of how to make institutions work and to engage in the educational endeavor. I have found myself refreshed at that well again over the last 2 days. Now, part of my role on this panel is to summarize the papers. And as you might imagine, any of you who have read Rod's papers, that is a daunting prospect. Office Politics in particular is about how some of the most important things cannot be summarized. Let me restrict myself then to a few taglines that describe these papers in chronological order so that we have a sense of their range. The first is Curricular Development in the 1980s, a Perspective. And this is in fact a paper from 1982, and it was originally a speech given to the annual meeting of the Canadian Association of Law Teachers in 1979. It uses the question of curricular reform to explore contested questions of legal epistemology, legal reasoning, legal creativity, legal mythology, and the extent to which law proceeds from doctrine or emerges out of engagement with practical relations. The second is Office Politics. This paper is an allegory of normative dialogue within a faculty of law, indeed of normative dialogue generally, of law, made up almost entirely of a chain of interlocking memos bearing upon a fictional allocation of offices within this faculty of law. The third is legal bilingualism. This paper, published in 1997 but long in gestation, is about the role of language in law and the great benefits of approaching law through multiple languages. The fourth, transdisciplinarity and trust, from 2000. This paper is about how we should conceive of transdisciplinarity, and as you might imagine, it treats transdisciplinarity as anti-disciplinarity, revealing the epistemological limitations of disciplines, trying to provoke those in different disciplines to learn from each other, and seeking to recover a more direct and organic engagement with culture and practice. And then the fifth is decolonizing law school. And this paper was delivered very recently at a conference on the future of law schools at the University of Alberta last year. It is co-authored with Tom McMurrow, who was a speaker on the previous panel, and is a frontal assault on a host of impositions that can divert law from its proper mission. Intellectual colonization, where one relies purely and simply on imported models. Professional colonization, where law schools neglect their academic mission and subject themselves to a narrowly professional mission. Market colonization, where they're subjected to a narrow market-based functionalism. Consumerist colonization, adoption of student consumerism rather than student provocation, that is, and colonization by doing what everyone else is doing. Although, interestingly, Rod's paper also decries the potential for the law schools to colonize other contexts. Now, the topic of this panel is pursuing virtue. All of us who know Rod's writing on legal education or have seen his interaction with students will have been struck by the moral tenor of his exhortations concerning legal education. His insistence that the study of law, indeed law itself, is about coming to know oneself, one's most fundamental values, one's commitments, one's life. So how are we to understand what Rod is doing in these exhortations, how he conceives of the nature of our search for ourselves and our lives in the law? The title of my remarks is A Society of Friends. I'll engage with Rod's thought and practice under three headings, the first two of which are entirely familiar, especially after the first day and a half of this conference, but the third of which is insufficiently recognized. Although, when it's perceived, I believe that it's central to an understanding of all that Rod does, and indeed central to his appeal to everyone in this room. It's also the aspect of his thought that is least understood, perhaps even the least understood to Rod himself. It's therefore one aspect of Rod's thought to which we need to bring our most concerted attention. The three headings are then, first, pursuing virtue, second, embracing pluralism, and the third and least understood dimension, the gift of prophecy. So, pursuing virtue. Rod insists above all on the primacy of substantive value. This does not mean that he's impatient with procedure. Anyone who knows Rod knows what an acute institutional sense he possesses. He knows the value of participation, knows the processes and the ethics of leadership and engagement that foster participation, reads people like nobody else that I have ever met, and knows what is necessary to move an institution towards decision. Moreover, his primary of law was initially administrative law. But he has also always insisted that the main purpose of any process is the affirmation and instantiation of substantive value, the cultivation of virtue, the perfecting of relationship, and the achievement of ends that are good in themselves. Procedure has always been a means to these objectives. He definitely is impatient with the displacement of substance by process. He realizes, however, that the nature of substantive value is often veiled, glimpsed only through a glass darkly. and thus an object of aspiration rather than accomplishment. Hence the emphasis in all that he does on activity, on pursuing virtue, on coming to learn who one is, on a continual and creative rediscovery of ourselves. And that, of course, is the role of process in his thought. It's about how we come to know who we are, how we come to be who we are. Embracing pluralism. But Rod is also a pluralist. He's devoted his life to affirming that law is made in our daily encounters, including our most intimate encounters. And that means that law is generated from the most intensely local milieu upwards throughout all society. And he is also alert to the fact that in these local interactions, we continually encounter difference, contrasting claims, imperfect understanding, and differences of language. Indeed, we encounter that diversity inwardly as we seek to reconcile our own plural identities as teachers, as researchers, as administrators, as members of a community, as parents, and as seekers after the deepest truth. The quality of our legal relations, indeed of our moral lives, is determined by how we maneuver among those contending voices. One sees that theme abundantly in the readings for this panel, in the range of voices in office politics, which are never fully resolved in a canonical interpretation, in the inevitable partiality of language in legal bilingualism, and in the incommensurability of disciplines in transdisciplinarity and trust. So pluralism plays two essential roles in Rod's work. It makes the local the arena in which the essential action is, and it emphasizes our perennial encounter with difference and our consequent need to develop relationship, interpretation, attention, and skills of engagement and integration as essential attributes of law. But are we caught irredeemably within within plurality? Can we break through plurality to truth? Or to put those questions with more of an edge, what stops the plurality of voices from blowing any sense of normativity apart so that difference overwhelms any possibility of harmony? What stops everything from spinning out of control? If two crucial themes in Rod's work are the primacy of questions of substantive value on the one hand and the inevitable plurality of voices on the other, what allows the whole to remain together? And this brings me to the last theme. It was alluded to yesterday when several speakers noted that Rod was fundamentally optimistic. But I think it has more substance than that. It has more structure than a mere sense of optimism suggests. It's integrally built into the foundation of his theoretical approach. For one thing, treating Rod's approach as merely optimistic fails to make room for the fiercely critical dimension of his scholarship, which Richard Yanda so eloquently called to our attention this morning. And I'll deal with it under the heading, The Gift of Prophecy. I don't know about you, but I've always been struck by Rod's commitment to the establishment of harmony. In his prescriptions for social interaction, in the way he conducts arguments, or even in his chairing of faculty meetings, where he often tries to mollify and cover over conflict, where he insists that we already hold a set of commitments that resolve our disagreements, where he suggests that there's an emergent truth around which everyone can converge, or in his approach to legal pluralism, where he's confident that harmony already exists within the fabric of our social interactions, and he attempts to bring that imminent harmony to light. Indeed, it often seems to speak that harmony into being. Now, Harry Arthurs referred to this phenomenon yesterday as magic realism. To me, it's that Rod speaks in a quintessentially prophetic mode. He deploys appeals that are like those of a prophet. He calls us to reflect upon ourselves. He exhorts us to attend to virtue. And in those appeals, he often uses devices that allude to an underlying and ineffable truth that cannot be spoken. He uses parables. He speaks in poetic terms. He makes statements like Zen koans that cannot be understood discursively, but that speak to us nevertheless. His mode of speaking is more than simply a description of what happens to be the case. It's more even than a prediction, of a future state of affairs. That's why the notion of optimism understates what Rod is doing. Rather, he's pointing to an underlying truth, seeking, through its identification, to call it into being, even against obtuse or malevolent opposition. He's speaking in exhortative mode rather than merely descriptive terms. When he speaks, for example, of the implicit and inferential norms that govern the interactions of the faculty of law, he does not mean that merely in fact there are implicit norms that the faculty follows. He's saying that there's a normative order that accords with the best sense of how this faculty might interact, with the best sense of what this faculty is. He asks us to recognize those norms as the ideal embodiment of this faculty and to make our conduct accord with those norms. That's why moral reflection into the deepest nature of ourselves is integral to this process. It's an attempt to invoke what we are truly meant to be and to exhort us to bring ourselves into alignment with that truth. In office politics, for example, one has a clear sense that there is, in that welter of voices and the memos, a truth that is struggling to manifest itself. One hears at points in some of those memos a voice that is clearly that of Rod. Don't get me wrong. He's utterly faithful to the allegory. No one voice completely gets it. The truth always needs to be completed by additional voices. Moreover, there's always an element of self-reflection, of the possibility of error, of the need to expose oneself to questioning, both, as everyone who knows Rod knows, both relentless questioning internally and the questioning of others in everything that Rod has written. But it's an error in relation to a truth that pre-exists the conversation. And that truth is not merely a descriptive truth, but a more fundamental truth about what we are meant to be. That truth is also evident in Rod's treatment of the realm of practice, of the inarticulate realm of practice in legal bilingualism. Rod emphasizes that norms exist before they're articulated in language. The norms are not dependent on being spoken to exist. Indeed, he thinks of the true norm as existing beyond language, and linguistic formulations as only approximating that norm, a norm that he also clearly conceives in the singular, not the plural. This also means that the norm is not consciously made by the parties. It emerges before they know that norm. They discover it. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but in legal bilingualism, doesn't the pluralism only appear at the level of language? Isn't the underlying norm something that is common, which exists as a norm before the parties seek to put it into words? Note the consequences of this for the specific character of Rod's legal pluralism. He genuinely affirms pluralism. He believes deeply in the multiplicity of voices. But he thinks of those voices as existing in relation to a harmony that lies beyond the people themselves. In an important sense, the harmony already exists. It's not simply constructed by the agreements and disagreements of the parties. Their task, our task, is to draw it out. Moreover, I don't think he sees this foundational harmony as contingent. That's why the language of optimism misses an essential point. It's not just that harmony might appear. It's not even merely that he hopes it appears. Rather, he has confidence that, at an imminent level, it already exists, and our task is to identify it and to instantiate it in our lives and our institutions. This involves a distinctive conception of responsibility, a responsibility to reflect continually upon what the essential harmony might be and upon what our relationship to it should be. Rod does believe that that responsibility is distributed to each and every one of us. His is an emphatically democratic conception of the prophetic role, in which we each have things to reflect upon and contribute. He envisages a true society of friends. That underlies his approach to pedagogy, where he seeks to exhort people, to provoke people, or to cajole them to seek after that fundamental truth. But that truth is not the product of their own will or even of their own intellect. It's something outside of themselves that they're charged with pursuing. This prophetic dimension of Rod's thought accounts, I believe, for much of its appeal. Its emphasis upon a harmony existing in principle but achieved in practice through relationship, the substance of our hopes, the fulfillment of our trust. It's calling of us back continually to attend to the affirmation of that good, to pursue virtue. And the collective conduct of that pursuit through the exercise of an emphatically individual moral and intellectual responsibility in the society of friends. Let me conclude by reading in full a passage to which Rod alludes, indeed which at one point he paraphrases in Legal Bilingualism. Whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. Thank you.
Rod has, as I understand it, Rod has asked that this panel be called Pursuing Virtue. Now, why did he do this? Well, I thought there's three reasons, perhaps. First, he wanted us to come up here and talk about his notion of virtue, as we interpret it from his writings. Second, perhaps he wanted us to come up here and talk about our own notions of virtue, as he has inspired us to think about. Third, perhaps he chose this title, Pursuing Virtue, because it is the act of pursuit that matters most, and that rather than urging us to any specific definition, he is inviting us to engage in our own reflection on what virtue means. I'm going to hedge my bets and discuss all three possibilities. Rod's notion of virtue. And here I'm mainly going to speak about the curricular development in the 1980s piece, a perspective, but as in the article that Andrew Petter mentioned, this was originally drafted in 1979, so is more of a prospective. After reading that piece, it dawned on me that one label I would assign to Rod's concept of virtue is that of human potential. Rod believes that legal education has the capacity to maximize and realize human potential. This conviction I suggest, has three pillars. The first pillar is what I would call discovery. All we need to know, we have within ourselves. You teach you, he tells us, not the subject matter. Law and life is autobiographical. So to teach, we must understand ourselves. We must apply that logic of discovery that he says legal study should inspire about law to ourselves. He exhorts that we are agents of our own learning and teaching. Our responsibility is to discover or rediscover the values that underlie our practices, to assert control over what we believe and what we teach, to get to know our own theory of life and legal knowledge that underlies what we do. If we do the hard work of discovering what we believe, if we pursue the continual and creative rediscovery of ourselves, we will imbue the activity of law teaching with meaning. The second pillar is diversity. In the article, Rod calls for diversity in all aspects of law school activity. Rod values, indeed reveres, the diverse range of talents, learning styles, and skills of everyone in the room. How many of us have heard him talk about the Kolb learning cycle, or have had him ask us to reflect explicitly on our own intellectual skills? This reflects a phronetic, as in phronesis, particularistic, idiosyncratic concern with individual talents. It celebrates our humanity. It also celebrates his particular conception of law. The idea that the lawyer acts as an architect of social institutions, as he wrote in 1979, 4 years after, he wrote about it in the thesis that Angela Swan told us about. That idea that it is the lawyer's job to navigate a range of diverse modes of social ordering implies that legal education ought to cultivate a set of diverse skills. Thus, the range of legal skills is commensurate with a pluralistic, limitless range of human capacities. This is one reason why a non-positivistic curricular structure has primordial importance, again from 1979. Exploding the sites and modes of legal inquiry maximizes the range of human capacities we value in legal education, promoting a virtuous circle whereby more graduates are more capable of accessing more of their own talents in the service of enhancing society through law. The third pillar I will imperfectly call divinity. I needed a D. Discover, diversity, divinity. I don't mean it literally, of course, although there are plenty of ecclesiastical references in his work. What I mean is that Rod's commitment to human flourishing is inflected with a commitment to substantive justice, substantive value. I think the iterations of that are multiple, ethics, and human goodness. Rod has faith in the human capacity for fairness. He writes that human beings autonomously devise decision-making institutions and deploy them justly. At the same time, he demands that human law teachers face up to their personal ethical theory, that they develop their own philosophy of knowledge and reform, and that they become self-consciously aware of the implications of what they are doing. For Rod, legal education is not so far from God. Rather, Rod both believes in our goodness and, like a divinity might, exhorts us towards it. On to my conception of virtue. So my current doctoral work examines how law professors conceive of their role as cultivating citizens. I interview teachers of first-year contract law and explore the extent to which their articulation of their mission involves a commitment to citizenship. I use citizenship because the term captures two distinct virtues. First, as a unit of concern, the citizen directs us to focus on the individual, to imagine that individual as someone who potentially has agency with respect to law and with respect to their own learning and life. It may seem obvious, but asking about the citizen is a different enterprise than asking about an institution or a market or a country. No surprise, given Rod's influence, that I try to shear the term of its stately connotations. That's hard to do. The term has heavy baggage, but I take Rod's lead. He uses the term citizen quite frequently in his writing. Citizenship is also good because it directs us to the public sphere in a sense of engagement or contribution. The citizen is the individual situated in the public sphere. The citizenship is the intersection of pure autonomy with a social network. and the citizen is subject to the demands of accommodation, including the need for social ordering, that results from this situation. The pursuit. My third question. Perhaps this, pursuing virtue, is a judo move designed to throw us off balance while we try to wrestle with this unwieldy concept, with the hope of enlisting everyone in this room to restore the balance. If it really is the pursuit that Rod is inviting us to do, let me expand the invitation by suggesting what the pursuit of virtue may imply for a future agenda of research into legal education. First, I think we need more empirical work to discover and name the aspirations of legal educators, to discover and rediscover the latent notions of virtue that underlie our current practice. Everything we need to know we have within ourselves, and scholarship can help identify, synthesize, and ultimately argue for a diverse range of virtue in legal education. Second, we need empirical work on students' experience and how this matches up with these imagined aspirations. We need both point in time and longitudinal studies to understand students' and graduates' conception of law, legal knowledge, civic, and professional identity. There are some current surveys, but they do a good job mostly at capturing surface phenomena. The third avenue is work on the curriculum. Rod writes that thoughtful curricular debate is a law school's primary heuristic device. I suspect that many of the implicit, powerful norms and values about the mission of legal education often only surface at the moments of inflection when a change to the curriculum is proposed or takes place. Wouldn't it be great if researchers had access to this wealth of intellectual capital so they could tease out the fundamental values which otherwise are mooted under a cone of silence? Rod gave us office politics. Give it to us twice. Who among us will write curricular politics or curricular virtue? Fourth, the sociology of legal education could be further deployed to explore the informal norms of the law school and its hidden curriculum. We need more pieces like Desmond Manderson's Coffeehouse article, but we also need to understand how other participants in legal education conceive of virtue. How, for example, do career development officers imagine the deployment of human potential after graduation? How do admission officers interpret human potential before admission? How do adjuncts and legal writing teachers and student TAs conceive of their mission? These are just examples of scholarship that would help us understand the frequency and content of virtue. Having articulated and developed these latent notions, the necessary next step will be to make much better arguments than we currently do for the social value of legal education. Rod's thinking invites us to conduct at least two distinct intellectual processes. The first is to probe beneath the surface phenomena to understand the values, commitments, and philosophies that underlie what we do. The second is to reject conventional mythologies, to challenge existing frames of debate, and to question the shibboleths of the legal academy. In today's contemporary debate on legal education, both of these skills are sorely needed. We are in a rather depressing iteration of the perennial debates. Rod called these perennial back in 1979, about theory and practice, control over curriculum, and a shifting legal marketplace. Law schools are under attack for their broken economic model and their failure to train for the marketplace. We can deploy the pursuit of virtue as a judo move in this debate. We can take this preoccupation with value and turn it on its head and show that there is an enduring, broadly conceived social value to studying and teaching law. If there is a crisis in legal education, it is only the result of a temporary failure of imagination and boldness. By heeding Rod's deliberately ambiguous invitation, I believe we can turn the great balance wheel and reaffirm, honor, and continue Rod's relentless faith in the greatness and goodness of the collective enterprise.
How do we know that this is a panel? Everyone must believe in something. I believe I'll go canoeing. Henry David Thoreau. I'm no paddler, but Rod is, and this is what I've learned from Rod's paddling, often upstream. Social learning is possible, and through it, the creation of shared understandings and shared meaning. Communication is a way for human beings to be alive. Rod. Law is one way for humans to communicate and to create meaning together. In fact, we can only create meaning as a social enterprise. None of us is able to do everything or to know everything such that interdependence is necessary. Rod. The creation of meaning through law does not presuppose a deep common culture or language. Meaning is built, not discovered. It is built through specific instances of discourse and dialogue, and through interpretation. Words limit, words liberate, words confound, and words enfranchise. Rod. We come to create meaning through law from our individual social, cultural positions, racialized, gendered, classed. We are shaped by power structures in our society. But because words can liberate and enfranchise, law is not determined by power, though it is affected by it. Law can have a critical purchase on power itself. Rod. I disagree with Harry Arthurs. In my own work, I've tried to demonstrate that social conceptions of law building up can accommodate analysis of power. Perhaps that's part of what Jeremy was referring to as an underlying harmony. Take everything as it comes, the wave passes, deal with the next one. Tom Thompson. Law's critical purchase on power is not the result of a causal link between textual rule, legislation, treaty, and behavior. Law works, matters, functions explicitly and implicitly as a morality of duty or rule and as a morality of aspiration. As Aristotle taught, rules are not enough. We create meaning through the use of rules in debate, discussion, interpretation, creating practical wisdom. Practice is the process of creating shared social meaning. It builds on shared knowledge and implicit norms that condition all textual rules. H.P. Glenn calls this tradition. Practice conditions all theorizing about law. Even so-called realists must construct practice as expressive of reality. This is a panel. Seeing the possibility of law or seeing only the imposition of interests through power are equally normative constructions. Rod and David Deisenhaus. There is no real world separate from the one that we build together. Within a set of practices, we occupy roles, democratic, prophetic roles, often overlapping roles, that demand the exercise of the Aristotelian virtues, ethical and intellectual. Weber called this responsibility, Fuller, role morality. In law, because of its construction as practice, this morality is like the pride of the craftsman. Not just technical knowledge, but the social art of ascribing meaning through legal interaction, through friendships. Finally, and crucially, law as communication and the building together of meaning through virtuous practice means that law is not merely a tool or an instrument. It can't just be used for other political, social, cultural purposes external to itself. Law is its own purpose. It has its own meaning, always in relation to other kinds of meanings. As Rod says, human value is not measured in market transactions. Steadily, day after day, he had forged ahead, sometimes moving easily on smooth water, as he was now doing, at other times poling up rough rapids, forcing his frail canoe up the rushing, foaming water and between jagged, dangerous rocks with a skill that few white men learn. Thank you.
My first reaction to this invitation was sort of alluded to by Rosie when she talked about how Rod had this ability to get you to do things and only later realize exactly what you'd been talked into doing. And I think Richard had been taking some of those lessons because Richard called not very long ago, it seems now, and of course the instant reaction was, well, of course I will. And I don't actually remember being told the title of this panel at that point, and I certainly don't remember being told that the readings were about yay thick. And so I was initially, my first reaction at that point, or my second reaction after I said yes, and was intimidation. Why was I intimidated? Well, I was intimidated partly because of the materials and the subject. And I will also say my co-panelists are not just brilliant, but they're still in the academic and legal education business. I'm a trial judge, called upon to decide cases on the basis of evidence and the law, I thought, to call them as I see them. If I were to start discussing the pursuit of virtue in my next set of criminal reasons, I might expect a complaint to the Judicial Council or an appeal. Madam Justice Abella, if it got that far, I hope that you'd show me some mercy in the circumstances. But as soon as I started reading, I became somewhat relieved. I began with the colonization piece. I was relieved, but I was also a little taken aback. And I'll tell you right now that it became quite a voyage of self-discovery, or real self-discovery, sort of renewed self-discovery for me. I was relieved because once I started reading the work, it was much more familiar than I had expected. And it brought home to me that these values have been part of me throughout my entire legal career, and how early these values were instilled in me. Now, I'd been thinking a bit about how I would, about adopting a particular few lines to describe the pursuing virtue as we've heard it described, but because Jeremy did such a great job, and because I don't want to be reductionist about this, I'm just going to let that be and talk about how the pursuing virtue, the Rod sense of pursuing virtue has influenced me. It began early on when I was a student, law student in Rod's first personal property class, and I now realize that these values run so freely in my veins that I've taken it for granted and done so for many years. And so that explains the sense of being taken aback as I started to think about Rod's influence more directly for this panel. I can't separate, and this is something that was alluded to particularly yesterday, I can't separate the influence of Rod's work in the narrow scholarship sense from the influence that his teaching, mentorship, and leadership as my dean, colleague, mentor has had and continues to have. This, of course, is part of the whole package. My brief remarks are going to be generally chronological. His influence as a teacher, colleague, dean, always as a mentor. But I must emphasize that none of this has been neatly sequential. It rather tells a story of iterative influence and converging circles. I start with law school. I had the great good fortune to begin law school during Rod's first term as a professor at McGill. I started law school at what I thought was the ancient age of 26 years old with a three-year-old in tow. It was a major juggling act. I thought I didn't belong, as I did not fit the, at least then, usual profile of a law student. Rod reached out to me as a student and gave me opportunities, beginning with hiring me as a law student and planting the seeds of graduate work in an academic career in my mind, that changed all that. Now, this faculty was unfailingly kind and generous to me, but there was a difference with Rod that I now understand that I didn't understand then. He saw my pre-law script and the obvious fact that it didn't comply with the usual chronology as a plus that added to the mix, rather than as an other that merited tolerance and perhaps some accommodation as necessary. As a student at McGill, I was impressed with the range of disciplinary backgrounds and perspectives, ages of my classmates, and I realized that this was something that had attracted Rod to McGill as a faculty member at that time. And remember, I arrived at the same time as Rod did, as did, by the way, Stephen Toop and Rosalie Jukier and a number of other people in this room, the same room, same year. So Rod had nothing to do with our admission. I'm sure that, the fact that there was such an interesting sort of disciplinary diversity of the class was a plus. And of course, the hypothetical I remember him presenting to us was the one that posited a car accident at the corner of Peel and Penfield and asking us to consider how a social worker, engineer, lawyer, doctor, economist, and urban planner would respectively describe what had happened. It was a wonderful and illuminating exercise that I've always thought of for many years and used in my own teaching. Under Rod's leadership, of course, and that I think of that first year as a point in time at which Rod had just arrived, the sort of seismic shift that Nicholas Cassirer talked about last night had started. There was fertile ground for it here, but to be honest, I'm not sure the faculty as a whole really knew what was about to hit them in that first term and first year. It had just started. Under Rod's leadership, the social and disciplinary diversity, again something we've heard a lot about in the last couple of days, became a more explicit part of McGill's admissions policy and one which I had the opportunity to participate in as a member of the admissions committee for some years. And obviously, here we see some of the broader and more very fundamental notions of pluralism and diversity that run through his work. And I just want to tell one brief anecdote about Rod as a teacher before I move on that one. My time came, I decided that, again, with some prodding, baiting encouragement from Rod, to apply for a Supreme Court clerkship. And Rod offered to write me a letter of recommendation, and there was some allusion yesterday to Rod's famous letters of recommendation. And so a day or so goes by, and he calls me, and he says, "Allison, I'm having a bit of difficulty with your letter." I said, "I figured it was game over." And he said, "I need to know what your hobbies are." And I said, "Rod, I'm on the Law Journal. I've managed to barely hang together through law school. I've got this little kid. I wouldn't know a hobby if it came up and bit me." And he said, "Allison, you've got to have a hobby, you know." And he goes down the list. He says, you know, "Do you play the violin? No. Do you act in the little theater? No. Are you a painter? No." And of course, I'm feeling more and more like a loser as this goes on. And finally, he says, "Nothing." And I said, "Well, you know, I have a few rose bushes, you know. I mean, this is about all I can think of." Well, I was described in that letter as an avid horticulturalist.
We have to tell them how it worked.
Well, I did get the job, but I'm still waiting for them to find out. So fast forward a few years to my life at McGill as a law teacher and my first term teaching as a young prof at McGill. Rod was dean. As I was getting back from my graduate studies in England in August and term started in early September, Rod told me he would give me a break. We would co-teach foundations to the entire first-year class, in this room, by the way, and it would give me a chance during the first term to get up to speed to teach my courses in the second term. I was impressed with his kindness and generosity. It did not take me long to see it a little differently. Rod took co-teaching very seriously. It did not mean we divvied up the courses and one of us showed up one week and the other showed up the other week. It meant that Rod, my dean, was in the classroom for every lecture I gave as a first-year law professor. In this room, and my memory, maybe it's not quite right, but my memory is Rod would be occupying that space very fully, gesticulating, walking around, and when it was my turn, I would be at the podium holding on for dear life. After the first lecture, we went to the tea room for coffee, and he said, "That was great, Allison. You only made 3 major mistakes." And it went on from there. One of the students in that class, who went on, amazingly, to take other courses from me, later asked me how I had enjoyed teaching the class, and he commented, "Yes, we noticed your hands didn't shake nearly as much by the end of the term." Now, that was quintessential Rod and one of my favorite stories, but it's also a very serious story. Co-teaching for Rod has never meant a way of stretching thin resources. It meant enriching the classroom environment. The students in that foundations class learned something about some legal theory and some law and comparative law and so on. But they saw their dean, a senior, brilliant, and challenging teacher, mentoring a young and experienced, newly minted law professor, and their comments to me showed me that they understood. More than I did, by the way, at the time. This young law professor, then young law professor, learned firsthand about engagement and mentorship and the sheer joy of teaching and learning from our students. I swear, by the way, that the students took courses from me after that to see how I was doing. Office Politics was published about the time I joined the faculty. It is a piece that has influenced me in many ways. First, in terms of thinking about administrative law and the complex, dynamic, and human nature of institutions and decision-making and the ways that Jeremy has already so eloquently discussed. Second, it illustrates the power of the allegory and the elegance of the simple example to develop complex ideas. Third, it is great fun and essentially so human. Despite the disclaimer about all the characters being fictional, some of us greatly enjoyed recognizing or trying to recognize certain colleagues or at least their styles in the memos. And I'll come back to that in just a second. Now, Rod's work influenced my academic work significantly, where common themes always considered the relationship between various social and legal orders, whether it was dealing with issues in new reproductive technology or family, the area of the family, and so on, and I'm not going to say any more than that. I want to turn now to my life as a dean at Queen's University, where I went from here. Of course, as a dean, office politics had increased significance for me. I discovered that the same characters and the same styles of justification, often self-justification, exist in every academic institution. Who'd have thunk it? Most recently, a new senior judge in my court was appointed, and one of his first vexing jobs was to deal with office allocation issues for both newly appointed and retiring judges. Guess what? Similar characters, similar patterns, and similar institutional issues. In short, there's a universality to the lessons of office politics that I didn't fully appreciate 25 years ago. And by the way, I gave our new senior judge a copy of Office Politics. As a dean, I became more conscious of Rod's influence because it was a priority for me to expand and enrich the academic and intellectual environments as much as I could. As Rod's work clearly flags, change is affected in a number of ways, but one of the main, the important ways of doing that is through student and faculty recruitment. To use a simple example, if you've got an appointments committee made up of people who all have graduate degrees from Utopia University, there will be a natural tendency to value similar applicants, whether as students or faculty, more highly than those with different credentials. I sought out, almost reflexively, but I think I had this McDonald with a D as a student. I had this McDonald bird on my shoulder that spoke in my ear when I didn't realize it, I think. I sought out and built on different disciplinary links. I tried to encourage graduate work on the part of prospective faculty members and students alike in a wide range of areas, trying to bring in a wider range of political and ideological views with a view to providing the opportunity, and this does come from the colonization piece, for students to learn law in a multiplicity of sites and concomitantly to become more diverse sites of normativity themselves. Doing this requires the promotion and fostering of values, the values that have to actually precede their creation. It's a very dynamic, discursive process. It involves top-down and bottom-up, and it means trying to build an alternative to a cozy, comfortable environment where everybody tends to think alike. I also have to add that often, like the devil in Milton's Paradise Lost, cozy looks really good. And of course, to the extent that you have a diversity, a multiplicity of identities, they have to be mediated and reconciled. It's always a work in progress. But the point is that the creation and encouragement of the virtuous law school and the mediation of those identities are iterative and dynamic processes that are hard work and great preparation for real citizens with legal great preparation for real citizens with legal educations who have participated in an institution with those values as students. Finally, I turn to the influence of Rod's work on me and my work as a judge over the last 9 years, and I won't say very much about this except that when I first started thinking about these remarks, my reaction was, well, that's going to be the shortest part because really, as a judge, given that you can't miss that the judicial function is not at the top of the food chain, according to Rod's pluralistic vision, the hegemony of adversarial adjudication. No student or reader of Rod's work, and certainly not in administrative law, can miss this. But I keep thinking over, as I reflect on this, about the ways in which Rod's work in pursuing virtue does enrich the work of a judge, not just in the most obvious area of the nature of deliberation, which invokes or should invoke a richness of considerations and identities and influences on the part of both the judge and the judged, and a good judge must always recognize, mediate, and negotiate. It's true also of a judge's role in a courtroom and in trying to foster meaningful participation in an environment which is in which the judge's role is pretty tightly circumscribed. The one example that I will give you where I've had to kind of hold myself down has been the first time I instructed a jury, I found it very frustrating because I really wanted to teach the jury. And that's actually very hard to do when you're doing a jury charge for reasons that I can't really discuss right now. But what I kept wanting to do as I'm looking at these 12 people over there and I'm delivering my charge, I wanted to say, you there, third from the left, you look like you're having trouble. Can I help you? What is it you're not understanding? But there are things you can do as a judge that show value for pursuing virtue in the rod sense. They include things as simple as making a point of saying good morning to the man in the dock who is not saying anything in the course of the trial because his lawyer doesn't want him to. It includes how you establish a tone in the courtroom. And it involves, as I've increasingly started to realize in the last few weeks as I've been thinking about these remarks, thinking about how you can think about your role as a judge in relation to the presence in the courtroom. So for me, it's also being a judge also means mentoring law clerks, teaching at new judges' school, programs for advocates, doing whatever I can to try to be a good institutional citizen, which again I thought I realize flows in my veins because of the Rod and McGill Kool-Aid. But it also means, being a judge also means trying to reconcile it all with being a mother, a grandmother, a partner, caring for an elderly mother who lives with me, and trying to read some non-law and have a sort of cultural, some sort of cultural and social life. I'm still juggling after 35 years after Rod first taught me in law school. Pursuing virtue is in part about mediating these identities. It's also taught me that they all feed on and reinforce the others. This is part of, and not a distraction from, the messy plurality of the not always harmonious identities that is life. That is what I think the wisdom of a judge should mean. It doesn't drive particular results, but it's an ever-present mediator of the process of judging and of deliberating. It is a much richer process than an impoverished model of adjudication as being the smart and merely analytical application of rules to the evidence might suggest. So the question is not how Rod's work has influenced my work, but how has it not? That would have been a much shorter answer. Thank you.
Well, when I first saw the title of this session, Pursuing Virtue, I thought it was intriguing, inspiring, and a little bit elliptical. Rod coined the names for this symposium's panels, and as I've done with a significant portion of his other writing, I'm going to edit the title of this session. Now, you may not believe that many people had much editing work at all to do with things that he's published, but you can more or less recognize essays that I refined with blue pencils for Rod, because textual negotiation with him typically resulted in the retention of two or three mixed metaphors in the first couple of sentences rather than eight or ten of them. And their main themes are generally set out before those papers' halfway point rather than at the end of them. And subtexts or buried themes generally got reduced in number from the double digits to the single ones. Rod thinks that assaults on the conventions of literary style are hortatory, strategic, and therefore you don't get far editorially. But in any case, I'm not bashful about moving around his prose, even when it's only a couple of words in the name of a symposium session. So, pursuing virtue, it seems to me, could have been cast as promoting the collective good, practicing wisdom, cultivating decency, aspiring to citizenship, or building character. And any of those alternative titles might have made this panel's theme a little more accessible without changing its thrust. Building character I rather like because it has special resonance with Rod in his own background. Some of his sense of the human spirit and its capacity developed from summers that he spent as a camper and counselor at Kirk Whipper's Camp Candelore in Ontario's Haliburton Highlands. And that summer camp influence on him is apparent in several papers discussed earlier in the symposium, like the Swiss Army Knife of Governance this morning, rabbits, ravens, snakes, turtles, paddling on Meech Lake, and so on. And indeed, you might even say that insofar as disciplinary and even topical fences are few and far between in his writing, maybe it's that impact of unbounded camp-like wilderness spaces that can be seen coming across in his scholarship too, in part theorized in Transdisciplinary and Trust. So, unlike this university's patriarch, James McGill, who canoed because he was keen to rendezvous mid-continent with his native fur trading partners as quickly and regularly as possible, summer camp paddlers don't generally go canoeing as a means to an end. Nor are sports like archery usually undertaken in camp settings because those archers are vying for membership on a Canadian Olympic team. Nor are crafts done by artisanal campers because those campers hope to market their creations at a prestigious one-of-a-kind craft show, for example. Summer camp activities are typically ends in themselves. They normally involve close and continuing relations with other campers and counselors, and they often foster ethical strength or a distinctive temperament. Rod said much the same thing about the pursuit of virtue in law school settings and other settings as well. He characterized that pursuit as an activity in which means and ends are conjoined, an activity in which norms are constructed and understood through social interaction, and an activity in which attention to the pluralism of communities and of the self, embrace of the implicit character of norms, and optimism about the human spirit's capacity for introspection are fundamental constituents. Facilitating the pursuit of virtue is perhaps obviously not the only thing that faculties of law or their sibling academic departments do. Most folks here can probably agree that university and other students should be challenged and changed by their learning experiences, but emerge from them confident of themselves. Students should probably also finish their studies sure-footed in their understandings of the skills and information that were presented to them there, and sensitive to the limits of professional or other cultural traditions that they appropriated through formal and informal education. But most folks can probably agree that virtue, wisdom, decency, citizenship, character are matters of pervasive and critical presence in legal education, in part due to the social and economic privilege that follow this training's completion in most North American jurisdictions, and to the self-regulating character of most local bars. Shading now into the impact that Rod's scholarship has had on others, working not just at academic writing desks, but in university committee rooms, in classrooms, and elsewhere, it bears recollection that almost 20 years ago, this faculty of law determined to restructure its private law curriculum, and there was at that time significant professorial opinion to the effect that the teaching and learning of skills, including the skill or state of mind called citizenship, should be as prominent in the new program as that of legal information, which meant that there should be planned course-to-course and year-to-year skills progression, and that the teaching of doctrinal topics as platforms for the acquisition of skills and the pursuit of virtue, needed to be justified not on the basis of the volume of library space occupied by that doctrine, but on the grounds that particular topics were especially suitable springboards for the engagement with skills and for introspection. And indeed, skills were then understood to be everything from legal issue spotting to doctrinal synthesis to the criticism and deconstruction of norms to memorandum of law and appellate brief writing to legislative and document draftsmanship to negotiation to mediation to reconciliation to arbitral decision making to scholarly and popular writing about law and so on. Virtue underlying all was then thought to have to do with transformations and temperaments rather than with sets of rules. And I think it's fair to say that although there was widespread participation in those processes of curricular reform, that Rod's influence was a significant part of the current of opinion that I just described. Consistent with his own writing, however, Rod also said that thoughtful curricular debate is a law school's primary heuristic or autodidactic device, and that the processes of collective debate that underlie curricular reform are therefore more important than the results of curricular reform. The promotion of a shared good, the practice of wisdom, the cultivation of decency, an aspiration to citizenship, the building of character, pursuit of virtue in a law school or any other community setting is obviously not a straightforward exercise. But Rod's provided good guidance in published role modeling and casual forms on how that project might proceed. Fostering among members of a teaching and learning community an appreciation of context, a sensitivity to human agency's omnipresence, both in the materials of study and the community itself, are important steps in that direction. That's so, said Rod, because citizenship or virtue is about the links between individuals and their communities. Membership in any group is about robust participation in its public space, and virtue is about a commitment to the common good. There's the scheme in anodyne form. Each community's norms are thus mystically crafted through interaction with the diversity of others at a range of sites, and most profoundly expressed implicitly or symbolically, I repeat, means and ends are necessarily conjoined in that interactive process, and the relevant morality is one of aspiration and optimism rather than one of fact or risk aversion. Those touchstones of learning, Rod routinely identified as techniques for the achievement of self-knowledge, and our look in the mirror or self-confrontation exercises. Most of my written work has been historical in character, and as such, I share an interest in contingency, human agency, everyday law, context with Rod. But I'd like to focus instead for the moment on the influence of Rod and his academic writing on my own teaching. And indeed, ironically, before and after pictures of classroom work and Rod's influence on it could be provided by other members of this panel, all of whom I taught. Allison, Jeremy, and Stephen would have to contrast their pre-1980s experience of me before I had much to do with Rod, with David Sandomirsky's quarter century later observations, after I'd had more to do with Rod. In any case, some course outline seeds that Rod provided became my administrative process course, built around worm's eye rather than bird's eye views of state action, an emphasis on the interactive relationship of bureaucrats with each other and their regulatees, the range of hard, soft, and implicit forms in which administrative norms can be expressed, and especially inter-systemic comparisons among delegated governments in miniature or sites of bureaucratic justice. I did something similar to that with a legal process course last fall, where previous teachers had made MacDonaldian, as Eric Reiter said this morning, MacDonaldian ambitions felt by using private law processes as scaffolding to teach dispute preemption and settlement skills alongside of inquiries into ethical lawyering. My experience with the administrative process class helped a lot. Touring diverse sites of justice and multiple legal processes is not only intellectually or spiritually liberating, but it also helps to move law school conversations away from the logic of justification and towards that of discovery. Similarly, the relational aspect of bilateral contracts became an increasingly large component of my contracts courses as time advanced, and multilateral contracts took on a big role alongside those other types of transactions. Some of my growth on those fronts is attributable to Angela Swan, who produced a series of published case books for those kinds of courses that opened the classroom door to reflections on the priority of human relations rather than legal artifacts in commerce. And I think it's no accident that several of this panel's themes were anticipated in Rod's own graduate work with Professor Swan of 40 years ago. But probably it's fair to say that most of my own evolution in the classroom, whether administrative law or contracts or legal history classroom, has had to do with Delphic-like missives that Rod routinely let fly in conversation by way of example or in scholarship about the multiple redistributive sites of contractual justice that exist, the ubiquity and subtlety of implicit, privately embraced commercial norms, and the commonwealth of each little legal system that's called a contract or an administrative agency. I want, therefore, to treat Rod's facilitation or pursuit of collective and individual virtue in the manager's office or in the classroom as a kind of text, at the same time as I want to treat his scholarship as political, ethical, and political action. The animating premise, I think, in respect of words and actions appears to have been that they're both texts that necessarily engage speakers, writers, and actors with their explicit and implicit rationality, an engagement that draws listeners, readers, and observers into a nomadic circle that's mutually constitutive and reconstitutive of the participants in it. Leadership within that circle thus consists of acting like a good facilitator or a good deflator of false consciousness or a good shaman. Let me end with an anecdote that in which is buried a modest prescription. I attended a reception in the dean's office here in my first summer, hosted by then Dean John Brierley, and there were guests milling around there saying, "Hello, Mr. Dean, hello, Mr. Dean, hello, Mr. Dean." That's a kind of distinctive McGill salutation that has lifelong currency. And I turned to then Professor MacDonald to ask what that was all about. And he gestured to one of the guests and explained that was Percy Corbett, who was Dean of McGill Law in the 1930s, and then he signaled another who was John Humphrey, dean designate in the 40s, and he gestured to Frank Scott and Max Cohen, who were McGill Law deans in the 60s, and finally he pointed out John Durnford, dean from the 1970s. In other words, I was looking at 50 years of institutional leadership at a single reception, And there's at least an indirect sense in which Rod stood on the shoulders of those forerunners to produce the 2.5 dozen examples of his written work that provided the basis for this symposium. There's more, however, going on than that. It seems unlikely that Rod could have produced the scholarship or the role modeling or the administrative achievements that he has based in an anarchistic law school environment like the Western Ontario one to which I first went, the patrician one at Columbia where I did graduate work, or the utilitarian environment that I saw doing more graduate work at the University of Chicago, and that it would be helpful for this community to think in summer camp parlance about just what kind of light is under this institution's bushel and deserving of fuller exposure and comprehension. What kind of light is it that enabled Rod to do what he did in this environment in a fashion that seems to me unlikely to have occurred elsewhere? And indeed, in that process, we may learn something about other understudied but intriguing McGill Law School citizens like Walter Johnson or Dorothy Henniker or Robert Warden Lee. And I think, too, that focusing on why it happened in this context might also help to reveal a closer linkage between this school's interleafing of norms, cultures, ethnicities, and language, and the way in which Canadian federalism, which Rod thinks is merely the McGill Law School writ large, may help to promote reflection upon how some dimensions of our federal union can be reimagined, and indeed that reimagining, I think, has already been attempted in other constitutionally oriented sessions of this symposium.
Well, the miracle that is Rod MacDonald is going to continue through a series of interventions. I think what we'll do is call out two or three names at a time so that the people with the microphones are spared the gymnastics of trying to go from one end to the other without knowing where they're supposed to go. So let's start with Margot Somerville. Where are you? Margot and David Lametti. So let's start with those two. Okay, Margot.
Okay, thank you. A few days ago, a colleague and I crossed paths in the corridor, and I just casually said, "How are you?" And she replied, "I'm worried." And I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Oh, it's disturbing information I've learned about one of my students." And she continued, "What do you do in these situations?" And my reply was, "I go to see Rod." And so many times over the years, I've knocked on Rod's office door seeking advice, and no matter how busy he was, and you could see he was terribly busy, he would always interrupt it, he was always willing to help, and invariably, he gave very wise advice, although I'm sure he must have thought, you know, what on earth is she disturbing me again for? But my choice of Rod as an advisor is a link to the title of this session, Pursuing Virtue. For me, pursuing virtue brings to mind virtue ethics, the idea that one can find ethically right or at least ethically preferable paths by having virtuous or right-thinking people make the decisions about ethics. And Rod is a paradigm example of such a person. I think that really sums up what everybody's been saying throughout these 2 days. Now, one of the texts selected for this session is a chapter in a book that I co-edited. It's called Transdisciplinarity, Recreating Integrated Knowledge. And that book resulted from a symposium that was held in a Cistercian abbey, a 13th century Cistercian abbey in Royaumont in France in 1998. And from my experience at McGill in the Centre for Medicine, Ethics and Law, I'd become convinced that we needed transdisciplinarity, but I had a lot of very strong opposition. Some people were furious with me about this. And so I went to see Rod and I asked him about it, and he was supportive. Although on one occasion he warned me, "Margot, you're dangerously on the edge of total bullshit." And I was very relieved yesterday to hear Kirsten Rundle say that he'd used the same word to her on one occasion. I thought I was probably the only person who'd ever received that sort of advice. Anyway, we arrived at this out in the middle of the Fields Monastery, and we'd invited 32 people from around the world. I refused to give them their ticket to Paris until they sent in a paper that we were going to use as a basis for our discussions. And when we got there, one of the participants came up to me and said, "Well, I don't know what I'm doing here. I certainly don't know what we're going to do for 3 days. Well, anything that was relevant could be discussed in 20 minutes. And I just absolutely freaked out. And I went to see Rod, and Rod was totally reassuring and said, "No, no, that's not right." And indeed, he was right as usual. It was a rich, wide-ranging, very varied and insightful discussion. And I'd add to that that many of the people at that symposium, and I think this is true of Rod's work generally, came to me afterwards and said that Rod's contributions were really amazing, that they were pivotal in achieving the success of the symposium. Rod's scholarship and contributions can be deceptive with respect to the novelty of his insights, because they exhibit the aha principle. When we hear them, they seem so obviously right that we feel that we've always known what he says. And we respond, "Aha," meaning, "Of course that's right, I agree." But we didn't know before what Rod was explaining to us. And that's become very much clearer to me at this symposium and listening to all the people who've expounded on Rod's work. Rod is above all a scholar of enormous integrity and authenticity. And here's a small example, which in its smallness shows how deep these characteristics are in his scholarship. Before he would give permission to publish his paper and his other contributions to the symposium in this book that I've got on my lap, he insisted that we include the following note on all of them. And I quote, "The author, that is Rod, wishes to note that he has agreed to accept American spelling only at the request of the publishers and in the interest of consistency of this text." So we had it published that on every single one. So I'd like to conclude by quoting from Rod's paper in Transdisciplinarity. And the first quote that I'd like to give you is this. He says, "The greatest obstacle to transdisciplinarity is a failure to trust those with whom we work. And the single most important determinant of this failure is our failure to trust ourselves, a failure to make ourselves vulnerable in the presence of the disciplinary others induce us to distrust the sincerity even of the disciplinarity of others who render himself or herself vulnerable to us." And I think that what Rod is talking about there is that two things, that we have to have earned trust, and I think Rod again is a paradigm example of earning trust, that is, trust me because I'll show you can trust me, not blind trust, which is based on status and authority and the idea that I know best, which, as you know, Rod rejects strongly. And Rod focuses as well on the necessity of communication and that it's essential to overcome pride and fright in order to communicate properly, and that comes strongly through in his book, in his essay in this book. So, quite apart from all the extraordinary intellectual gifts that Rod has and shares with the rest of us, I'd like to tell you as well, and it's probably true for some of the women, I doubt, maybe it's for some of the men too, but Rod is the best hugger you have ever met, and he gives hugs especially when we need them most. So thank you, Rod, for all your wonderful contributions that have so enriched the thinking and scholarship of so many of us, and most especially, from my personal point of view, your unfailing support and friendship.
David?
Thank you. Perhaps the most important thing in my view of Rod's practice of virtue is the example that he has given all of us. We shouldn't let it go by without noting that this room is full of people touched by Rod who have gone on to become law deans. 8 or 9, I think, if we count Natalie Desrosiers and Jeremy Weber twice. And it may be higher. Senior university administrators in this country and in other countries, a vast amount of a number of public servants and servants within the university, associate deans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a testament to Rod's example to all of us.
Thank you. Dennis Klink. Where's Dennis? Dennis? And where's Camille Cameron?
Thanks a lot. I'm Dennis Klink. I taught at McGill for 27 years. I'm now retired. In preparation for this, I sort of looked at the materials, and many things jumped out at me. And I was struck by the number of things that resonated with me. And so I sort of tried to settle on a few. And I came up with virtue, transdisciplinarity, and legal pedagogy. And I knew that I was given a minute to 2 minutes to talk about these things. So I thought, I'll drop virtue. I must say that if I had known that a law school was a community of persons seeking how to live virtuously, I would have been much less diffident over the years about some of my fundamental commitments. I conceived of law school as something else. Anyway, so that's kind of an insight that comes too late. It's an experience I've had of life. So, thou shouldest have been wise before thou hadst been old. That's King Lear. So just a little bit about legal pedagogy and transdisciplinarity. When I was hired at McGill, not by Rod, as a matter of fact, by John Brierley, my only formal legal training was I had an LLB from Saskatchewan. Okay. Now, a few years ago, I was offered the possibility of retroactively translating that into a JD, which is a much posher sort of degree. But they wanted $50, and I did a I did a cost-benefit analysis, and I decided I'd rather keep the $50. Anyway, so I came here. I gave a job talk, which was a very doctrinal, narrowly focused paper. I was hired by McGill, which is really bizarre. I just have no idea. I used to say, well, they're a national law school, and I guess they're looking for representatives of every possible type. So why not get a naively positivist common lawyer, essentially unilingual from Saskatchewan? That's one of the national types. Anyway, so I want to move a little. Now, Rod affected me or influenced me in many ways, but I want to move sort of ahead because I think one of the big influences, and this is a bit reminiscent, I think, of both what Rosalie and Allison said, but I'm a little narcissistic, not to say paranoid, and I feel that probably a conversation went on something like this at some point. What are we going to do about Klink? And so at a certain point, I was told I was going to be teaching foundations of Canadian law, which is mentioned by a number of people already, with Rod and with Daniel Jutra. Now, we weren't team teaching, thank God. But the book was essentially, the materials for the course were essentially Rod's view of law and the world. And I was reluctant to get into this because I wanted just to be where I always was. But anyway, so this was a very influential thing to me. And I have never deliberately tried to use Rod's scholarship as a basis for anything I've done, but I think implicitly and inferentially. there's a lot of it there as a result of that foundations exercise. So now, I used to teach evidence, but the last time I taught it was 1994 here at McGill. I foolishly offered to teach common law property, and Stephen Toop assured me I would get evidence back. I never did. but now I have... Now I am retired and living in New Brunswick. I've had the opportunity, partly at the urging of my very persuasive colleague here, to teach evidence again. Now, I think everybody should engage in the particularly masochistic exercise of teaching a course that they haven't taught for 20 years. But the thing about this course is I taught it previously before Foundations with Rod, and now I'm confronted with teaching it again after Foundations with Rod. Well, the first topic I start with is relevance. It's the basic rule of evidence. It's for evidence to be admissible, it has to be relevant. Okay, and I have my notes from 1994. I spent about 10 minutes on relevance, but the basic not concept. But if you look at judges, what judges say about relevance, it's connecting fact A and fact B by processes of logic and based on human experience. Processes of reasoning and everything that everybody's ever done. Anyway, I think part of the effect of Rod on me was now when I see a description of the sort of basic process of relevance as involving logic and human experience, I can no longer quickly pass over it and just sort of cite what a judge has said, but it's opened up huge vistas. Now, in some ways this is a good thing, in another way it's a horribly paralyzing thing, because I can't go on from this because it's too big. Now, for pragmatic reasons I have to go on, but part of what I'm asked to do here, well, the influence, and what would you do about it? Well, I guess a combination of Rod and his bringing my attention to the breadth of some of these issues, and St. Augustine, who said that you can't understand anything until you love it, and perhaps that brings virtue back into this, and you can't really love something until you embrace it fully. So I thought, well, I mean, what could I do? I could come up with a transdisciplinary course called evidence, or maybe even relevance, but I'm not competent to teach it. Who could we get to teach it? Well, Rod wrote a thesis, Prolegomena to a Theory of Legal Relevance. Who else to teach it? Okay, well, this brings home to me a little matter with respect to the title of this whole symposium, which is The Unbounded Level of the Mind. Now, I am a hopeless textualist, so of course I went back and read the essay on criticism of Pope. And in fact, if you look at the excerpt from the poem, it's not the unbounded level of the mind, it is the bounded level of the mind. So this little experience has led me to say, well, yes, it's nice for Rod to be able to do this stuff, but what about those of us whose levels of the mind is bounded? I think that there's room for more inquiry there, and I have some ideas, but I know I've talked longer than I should, so I'll leave it at that. But again, thanks to Rod for enlarging my mind.
I'm next. My name is Camille Cameron. I'm the dean from the University of Windsor Law School. And my most important job here today is to bring a warm welcome to Rod from everyone at Windsor Law. I want to tell you that we're proud of the connection. Your work has enriched over the years the Windsor Yearbook of Access to Justice. And I suspect that both your scholarship and your presence there have some contribution to our ongoing commitment at Windsor Law to live access to justice in as many ways as we can and to make it part of the fabric of the place. So I bring you thanks and greetings from everyone at Windsor Law School. Second, I briefly want to say thank you to the people who've organized this for just a wonderful symposium. Finally, just a brief comment on Rod's work and what has influenced me. I'm only going to point to one article. It's been mentioned by a number of the panelists, and it's the article on curricular reform. And as a Canadian law dean these days, that's a topic of some very considerable interest. It's interesting that an article written in the 1980s is still so timely. One of the lines in the article that stays with me is that thoughtful curricular debate is a law school's primary heuristic device. It is so true. In his article on the topic, Rod then goes on to tell us masterfully what thoughtful might mean in that context. It's a beautiful, if I may say, explanation. We don't ask a question like, should we teach torts? What we do if we follow Rod's advice is to ask whether we should teach it at all, how we should teach it, and if, when we teach it, to identify ways we can remain critical and understand that all of the choices we make about how we teach it contain value judgments, are not ethically neutral. And I think looking forward and looking into the future, as I think we've been asked to do as interveners, my contribution or my use of Rod's work is going to be in ongoing and pressing discussions we're having now about professionalization in Canadian legal education, to try to call on the work he has done to perhaps bring some virtue into that discussion. Thank you.
Anne Saris and Kate Glover. Kate, Anne is not here. No. Kate?
Okay. Hi, I'm Kate Glover, and I'm a doctoral student here at the Faculty of Law, and Rod is my supervisor. And I could certainly go on and on about the influence of Rod's texts, as well as their context and their subtext, on my doctoral research. But given the topic of the panel today, this afternoon, I'd like to use my minute to talk about two lessons from Rod's scholarship on legal education that shape my everyday work of being a doctoral student and of trying to decipher what the doctoral process is about and my role in it. So the first lesson has to do with the saying, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And basically the lesson is that the saying is completely wrong. From Rod's work, we learn that a student's imitation of her teacher, and certainly, or including a doctoral student's imitation of her supervisor, is a deep breakdown of the learning process. And the process should never be one of blind imitation. Rather, doctoral studies, like legal education generally, should be a process with a lot of the qualities that we've talked about today and heard about in this panel, a process of rigorous self-reflection, about learning to make our lives our own, as Tom said earlier, about becoming our own teachers, about discovering and pursuing our own conceptions of virtue, and it should be, as David said, autobiographical. The second lesson is reflected in the idea that Rod has told me many times, and maybe many of you, which is, if as a teacher, and I'm quoting from an email that Rod sent me a couple of months ago, if as a teacher you are not so nervous that you have to visit the bathroom before every class, then you've become stale and you should probably just start looking for another job. And I think this lesson applies to the exercise of doctoral studies as well. It should make me nervous every day when I sit down at my desk or open a new book. And if it doesn't, then again, there is a breakdown in the process. And the nerves come from confronting my own ideas about law and asking the hard questions at every step of the way and unlearning everything that I thought I knew. But this unsettling, these nerves are also the motivator of doctoral studies, and they are the drive to keep learning, to keep getting up every day, to keep sitting down at my desk, and to keep seeking and discovering. So I've spoken to a number of doctoral students over the course of this symposium, some of whom are here and some of whom are watching online. And the common theme of all of them has been that the symposium has been a reminder, or this engagement with Rod's work has been a reminder to be daring and optimistic and virtuous in our doctoral studies, but but also to be ourselves and to pursue the questions, big or small, that really get under our skin, regardless of what we think might get us a job at the end of the day or what might be a sexy topic to study at the time. So from all of them, and certainly from me, thank you, Rod, for all of the lessons that we learned from you and for making us very nervous, but for inspiring us to find the joy in it.
Well, they're going to Jay Ellis and Michelle Moran. I think I should make disclosure that Kate was a fantastic law clerk of mine at the Supreme Court, and the reason I hired her was there was nothing about horticulture in her reference letter. Jay Ellis?
Hello, I'm Ann Soat, not Ann Saris.
Oh.
And I am a lawyer who runs a legal clinic in law and aging and an institute. I was a student of Rod's, and I was a very nervous student of Rod's, very eager, but I felt that I certainly had disappointed him because I really could not understand administrative law. And our final exam, 100%, was one question: how in 1982, how is the Charter of Rights and Freedoms going to affect administrative law over the next 10 years? And I said, holy crow. And we, what was it, a 3-hour exam? Somehow I came out unscathed, but and after that, my contact with Rod, I went on back to a big law firm and was nose to the grindstone, and I then decided to strike out on my own. Came very generously to see Rod, who gave me some tips, some very practical tips. It wasn't a discussion of the law. And I went off and I started a new field of law, law and aging, and then had these wonderful opportunities to have an experience, not just with Rod, but first with his wife, unbeknownst to me, Shelley, this wonderful woman who is a psychogeriatric social worker, and of course the approach in our field, and certainly in my practice, is one of transdisciplinarity and working very, very closely with my colleagues in clinical fields. And I said, this woman is so visionary, so human, unassuming, but quietly assertive, and she just gets it, and she accomplishes things, and she fights very, very quietly, but she gets it done. And then after the fact, I find out, oh, that she is married to Rod McDonald, and somehow I said, there's something right in all of this. This is a perfect compliment. This is just wonderful. And then I did get to be inspired, particularly by Rod and a field I didn't know that he had touched upon, because I had really been away from McGill, was access to justice. And I was explaining to my students, I've had students in my clinical course since 2007, and I was explaining a few years ago to one group of students as they were coming in about how wonderful it was to, you know, to be thinking in new ways. In our field, we were new lawyers. We were different lawyers. Most people call me a social worker, a lawyer wrapped up in a social worker. And in fact, I take that as a great compliment, and that our approaches are human and practical and non-adversarial. And so, and this lawyer, and this student said, you're saying what Rod McDonald said. Have you read this article, Small Claims Can't? And I said, no, you know. And I rushed off to get it, and I said, oh my goodness, this is validation for all the fights, all of the struggles to represent the kind of clients that I represent, the most disadvantaged people, people no one would represent in terms of due process, principles of presumption of capacity, audi alteram partem, that are fundamental to our everyday practice. And here was somebody saying exactly what I needed to hear, which was, keep going. You're doing right. This is what we need. What Rod was saying in that, and he was doing it with a colleague, of course, and it was a wonderful piece of work, but the conclusion at the end was that all of these various marginalized groups, including older adults, did not perceive their most important problems in life as being legal problems, as having a rights base. And I said, that is the missing element. Of course, fundamentally, I knew it instinctually. I was acting upon it. We were working and using all of these various approaches. But that was the missing ingredient, was that not only did they not perceive that they had a right, and hence access to justice was prevented, but the professionals who were dealing with them did not perceive that their problems were legally based. And it was that insight. So whenever I go to this St. Zik, because my field is very much caught up with not just principles of law, but principles of ethics, and these members of the St. Zik say to me, Maître Soden, lâchez pas, lâchez pas. You're doing right, just keep going. I think of the aspirational values of Rod MacDonald, and I'm sure he's saying to me, lâchez pas, lâchez pas.
So remaining on the list, I gather Jay Ellis is not here anymore. So we have remaining on the list Michelle Morin, Susan Drummond, Erwin Cutler, and Angela Fernandez. So Michelle Morin.
Donc, je voudrais dire que je ne suis pas tombé dans la potion magique McGillienne, pour, si je peux traduire de cette manière la référence au Kool-Aid, même si j'ai débuté mes études en 1979 de l'autre côté de la montagne. Et ça a été un peu un choc, puisque la littérature que j'ai eu à lire au cours de ce cheminement juridique était presque exclusivement en français. Mais comme assistant de recherche, j'avais eu l'occasion de lire les textes de John Durnford sur les vices cachés. Et le deuxième texte qui m'a beaucoup marqué pour ce qui concerne la littérature anglophone sur le droit civil, c'est celui de Rod MacDonald sur les droits corporels mobiliers, la revendication et ses substituts. Un tout petit texte en deux parties qui fait 225 pages. Et je pense que c'est une mauvaise influence sur ma propre production que celle de Rod MacDonald d'avoir encouragé un penchant que j'avais, parce que j'ai toujours beaucoup de difficultés à comprendre pourquoi on se plaint de nos jours quand j'envoie un texte de 125 pages, ce qui est quand même beaucoup plus court que celui que Rod avait publié. Mais plus fondamentalement, ça fait partie de l'identité de Rod et de sa vertu, comme de celle de beaucoup d'autres collègues de McGill, d'être un parfait civiliste dans sa langue maternelle et dans une autre langue, d'intégrer ce bilinguisme et ce bijuridisme, et je tenais à signaler. Et ça a été vraiment pour moi une découverte. Donc, comme le temps m'est compté, je vais passer plus vite. L'autre rencontre intellectuelle, c'est évidemment ses théories sur le pluralisme juridique, qui ont été très déstabilisantes pour moi. Et là, comme on nous a demandé d'être francs et critiques, je dirais que tellement déstabilisant que, contrairement à Sébastien Grandmont, je résiste encore. Et je suis un peu resté arrêté à l'étape dont parlait Sally Engle-Mary, c'est-à-dire est-ce qu'on peut, même si c'est une question de mots, mettre exactement sur le même pied le droit officiel et le droit non officiel en parlant de droit et en parlant de processus décisionnels très différents, est-ce qu'on ne perd pas quelque chose? Dans mes propres recherches historiques, en tous les cas, je pense que j'ai trouvé des endroits où on présumait qu'il y avait un ensemble de normes et de réflexes non juridiques, et je pense que ce n'est pas toujours le cas. Et la présentation de Jérémy faisait bien ressortir cette aspiration à ce qu'on trouve en dehors du droit étatique des normes qui existe, et je pense qu'il y a certainement un danger à ça, danger ou piège dans lequel sont tombés les anthropologues, de chercher à trouver une norme, même si elle est exprimée par plusieurs voix, même si elle résulte d'arguments, même s'il y a un processus. Je suis pas sûr qu'il y ait toujours cette norme, mais ce qui est très déstabilisant, c'est que je ne peux pas écarter cette hypothèse, que je dois toujours m'y confronter, je dois toujours chercher. Je pense que c'est ça que Rod veut, et c'est de ça dont je le remercie.
Susan Drummond.
Okay, first of all, what a huge pleasure to be here. I've got two of my doctoral supervisors on the panel, and I've had my so-called purple prose, that's the phrase that Jeremy Weber used for me, corrected by Blaine, so it's nice to have them both on the panel, of course, to be amongst all of my professors. It's like a two-day incredible distillation of my entire medical experience in the law school. Also, it's a huge pleasure just to hear everybody here. I'll begin the whole mixed metaphor stuff, riffing on Rod MacDonald. And I want to start by going back to something that the story that Patrick Macklem told, and it relates to Allison's experience as well. I've got up to grade 7 in the Royal Conservatory in piano, and which is totally boring, let me assure you. And then 2 years of saxophone, but that's in high school. Nothing like taking Rod MacDonald to a place where it would be bikers, that you'd be listening to music. So the idea that I would have to have some much more creative understanding of music is very daunting to me in terms of the endless interview that Rod MacDonald puts you through. That said, I want to start by doing autobiography, the law through autobiography, which I'm not actually sure I believe is a good approach to the law anymore, but I'll start from that and just start from before I actually got to law school. I came to McGill because I wanted a job, like a lot of students do when they come. And I had a vague idea there might be a vocation in law. I had an idea that it might have something to do with social justice. I wasn't sure. I never thought there would be a vocation in the study of law or in the teaching of law. This is before I came to McGill. Certainly being here, I think in the very first month, I hadn't read Duncan Kennedy's piece about the first year law curriculum and how brutalizing it is. And I know walking through the law schools, I had determined I was quitting. There was no home here for me in law. It wasn't a home. It was a prison, the law was. And I ran into Jeremy Weber, who said, I think the word was evocative enough to make me stay on. He said, don't let the pricks in law school get you down. He wasn't talking about people. He was talking, I think, about the prison-like feature of studying the law. So I persisted, and I had Rod MacDonald for foundations, and sitting in his class, the law started to vibrate for me. I started to feel it. I started to feel it in my other classes as well, but most particularly in Rod's class, talking about legal pluralism. It never seemed like a vibration that had any kind of practical home I could live in. It was fascinating. I was charged. I could stay in law school with it, but I never felt like I could actually live in that home. I continued through law school. I really didn't know what I was going to do in terms of jobs. I was intrigued by what I was hearing from all my professors, Rod in particular. I didn't ever think I could do anything with it. But then what ended up happening is I was in fourth year law school, and I got pregnant. It was not planned. I got pregnant. And my immediate thought was, why can't the father of my child was an ethnomusicologist. My immediate thought was I need to do something practical. I need to use the law and build a home, and that means like corporate law or something like that. I was absolutely desperate with my ethnomusicology husband-to-be who wanted to go to southern Spain and study flamenco, Spanish flamenco, and I was desperately telling him, that's insane. We'll never, never get a job. I'm pregnant. Don't you understand? I need to work in the law. I were going to my interviews and not being able to zip up my skirt in the interviews. Of course, I never got a job offer because I was showing already. That having happened, the marriage eventually did not last, and I knew that it was heading in that direction at the time. I was Marcia Clark was in the media in the O.J. Simpson trial, and she had her children removed from her, if you remember, because she was working full-time. And I knew the marriage wasn't going to last, and I just thought, well, there's two of Canada's leading family law jurists on the panel. I knew there was all that talk about formal equality, and I could just picture Mr. Mom staying at home if I forced him to stay in Canada and I worked as a lawyer 80 hours a week, I would lose my child. So I did something which was absolutely impossible, would have been impossible to conceive of 10 years before Rod MacDonald came to teach at McGill. My husband was going to go to study flamenco music in southern Spain, and I just thought, I'm desperate to keep my child with me, have custody of him. I thought, I'm going to shack up a doctoral thesis on Spanish Gitano family law, and I'm just going to land there because it seemed totally remote, but Rod MacDonald had talked about pluralism. So I scrambled about learning about Spanish formal state law. I scrambled about to the McClellan Library, but everything I could on Gypsy, Roma, ethnography, and actually there's way more books there on that topic than Spanish family law here at the Law Library, and Roman Catholic canon law, and like Hoi Kong was saying, I was absolutely terrified. I left where the light was shining, and I thought if I just land there, I'm never going to get a job doing this, but let me just scramble about in the dark and see what Rod kind of intimated. There might be something there you could build a home out of thinking about it. So I did do that. To get back to mixing all our metaphors here, I not only imbibed the Kool-Aid, if you remember the Kool-Aid, people died from the Kool-Aid in Jonestown. Having imbibed the Kool-Aid, and actually having ended up homeless in my parents' cottage in the Laurentian Mountains because I had no money at the end of my grants for 4 months, really we had zero income, I ended up getting a job teaching at Osgoode. So I ended up surviving all of that, and I found progressively, obviously, I'm still here, I was able to build a home in the law. It became something that had a vocation for me. It wasn't a prison anymore. It would have been, I think, before Rod came to McGill and it became possible to do the crazy doctorate that I ended up doing, to even think of doing something like that. It became a home for me, the law. And hearing people talk as well as we go through this, the idea I originally had going into law school, I wanted a job. The exact kind of thing that 7 years of the Royal Conservatory of piano lessons give you, not the riffing that has been happening here. I was able to abandon that idea of what I thought the law ought to be by moving through that terrifying period of thinking of the law differently, and find that it really was possible to build a place in the law, even the way that, if you think of all the things that Rod has done with the Law Commission, the Royal Society, the standard law things that you think of when you enter law school, it's possible to build Rod's kind of home in the law and live within it. And in a period where people have been talking about, we're moving from shrinking from being a law faculty across Canada to being a law school again, using what Rod has laid down, we need to start moving again into this very dark period where there's no light shone and try to rethink what we mean by a law faculty and law as a vocation, either as a practice or as a study or as a profession where you're a teacher. Thank you, Rod.
Erwin Kotler.
I think one of the incredible things of this symposium, in terms of not only this panel, but the panels before and the interventions, is that I don't think I've ever been at an academic symposium where each of the panelists, each of the intervenants, all the people in the audience have been so impacted upon by one person, by Ron MacDonald, not only his person, but his works, which has contributed not only to what we do, but to who we are. I think that alone is the most incredible and compelling justification for this symposium and tribute to Rod MacDonald. I just want to say I first encountered Rod when I was teaching at Osgoode Hall Law School. He was my student in one of the first courses taught in law and poverty. He ended up getting an A. I already, you know, witnessed that incredible, what was to be that unbounded legal imagination wedded to the pursuit of public virtue. But I have to say that him getting an A validated the course, which had some question about it, amongst the students, if not myself, as a teacher. And during the course of teaching Rod, I, in fact, became the student of the person I was teaching. And it has remained that way. I was his student while an academic colleague here at McGill Law School during his deanship, and then as a member of Parliament and as a Minister of Justice. And whereas a Minister of Justice, his sense really of what, as Rosie Bella called, a law in the pursuit of a kind of an aspirational justice, really helped to underpin my work. And I like to think that one of the most important things I had the privilege to do, which was judicial appointments, that Rod's work on the integrity of the judicial appointments process and the importance of the excellence of those judicial appointments contributed, since this panel is to be looking to the future, to perhaps some of the most important legacy issues I did. The first being the appointment of Rosie Abella to the Supreme Court of Canada, which will inure forever to the administration of justice in this country, and also appointing Alison Harrison Young to the Ontario Superior Court. It's fortuitous that they're both on the panel, but this has been one of the more enduring things. Let me just conclude by saying that I've always regarded Rod as really being the quintessential Renaissance legal scholar and educator and public intellectual, person whose scholarship has always informed his teaching, whose teaching has always informed his scholarship, where both have been underpinned and inspired by that sense of public virtue, by that sense of an unbounded legal imagination, where the whole has had a transformative impact on law, on society, on legal education, and in the end of the day, we are all the beneficiaries of Rod MacDonald, and Rod, we will always be forever your students. Thank you.
I don't think it's inappropriate, before I call on Angela Fernandez, to acknowledge the fact that you've just announced your retirement from politics, and all of us, as people who benefited from the spirit of Rod MacDonald and McGill, that you took nationally as Minister of Justice and as a parliamentarian from Montreal to the rest of the country and the world, owe you an enormous debt of gratitude. If it's difficult to work in an academic environment, it's impossible to imagine what it's like to be on display in the public world of political public policy. So thank you for making that sacrifice for us. And finally, Angela Fernandez. Sorry, did I miss one? This is like a revival meeting.
I will be very brief. Since Erwin has spoken, I guess I'm the other voice of the pre-MacDonald era, and I simply would like to reinforce what everybody else has been saying about the extraordinarily transformative impact of Rod MacDonald. I was there 3 years before. It was already a remarkable place with remarkable colleagues, remarkable heritage. I could go every morning and have coffee with F.R. Scott and Frank and Max Cohen. But Rod's arrival brought something truly extraordinary, truly transformative, and we're all deeply, deeply in his debt. And I would like to say, like everyone else, I'm personally in his debt as a friend, as a dean. I remember his motto, "Do it now." The other wonderful motto he had, said once to Vice Principal Friedman, "Family first, pursuing virtue." Thank you.
At last, Angela Fernandez.
Okay, Angela Fernandez, Faculty de Droit, University de Toronto. When I was a student here in the mid-1990s, I must say I actually rather prided myself on not being a McDonaldite. But honestly, I can't quite remember now why that was. It's been about, 15 years or so, and I'm feeling like, is this going to keep happening and, accelerating this loss of memory? But I think it had something to do with the pluralism position and the question of designating non-state law as a law. It seemed to me, and it still does to some extent, seemed to me to be a legal fiction and problematic in terms of law colonizing everything. Suddenly, everything was law. There was no non-law, which is not, I think, how we experience our lives. So, I rebelled. Sometimes it's only in resistance that one can create one's own identity and voice. That said, I'm not sure that anyone noticed me rebelling. And certainly, the people who I worked with most when I was here as a student. So Blaine Baker, David Lametti, Nicholas Kassir, who are sitting here in a nice triangle, never asked me about this or questioned me about it, although here again my memory may be failing me. We may have had conversations about that I now don't recall. I didn't come back to McGill to teach after I did my clerkship and my graduate training, even though in many ways I would have loved it. Just to be clear, it was not because of legal pluralism. Toronto had many attractions, but also due to personal reasons, which we don't like to officially acknowledge, but which are always there and can be, in the end, I think, sometimes the most important reasons. And I think that's a very Rod-like point. Okay, so did I rebel? How to evaluate this and measure this? Well, I can look at what I'm currently doing, and that may give me some sense. So I'm currently working on a book about the famous early American Fox case, Pearson and Post, which many of you probably know. This is a case in context, a work of legal history. It's the case in its original context, and also in its received context. So how it ended up in all American property case books, on almost the first page of those case books, I'm looking at the ideological significance of this and what it leads us to say about the legal profession in the early 19th century, but also today. What else am I up to? I'm co-organizing with a colleague who teaches the history of material culture, an interdisciplinary working group at the Jackman Humanities Institute on animals and the law and humanities. In this group, we've got historians, philosophers, people from the English department, political science students, religious studies. We've got lawyers working in the field, people who are teaching animals and the law at Osgoode and at U of T. We've got regular old U of T folks like me. And what are we discussing? We're looking at issues of humanism, post-humanism, animal rights, and the like. My carry-on bag for this weekend, and I find a carry-on bag is always a good window on where one's mind is at any given moment. It contains copies of Mikhail Bakhtin's Rabelais' World and the Poetics and Politics of Transgression, which I'm using for the fox hunt work, believe it or not. So here it is, just from this, I think you can see, or at least we can say arguably, I actually did not rebel. That I had, against my own intentions, become a McDonaldite. And I realize, coming to this conference this weekend, at least three very important things that so far I've been learning from this wonderful reunion. First, one can actually come home through resistance, which is what happened to me. Secondly, a person can have more than one home, both intellectually, physically. I'm thinking Blaine, I'm thinking Catherine Valk, who spoke here also yesterday, also Toronto, Montreal people. And thirdly, and finally, in the end, you are your own home. Rod, I'm going to sing a little song. And this song is for you in your home away from home. I offer it in the spirit of the same kind of transgressive play that Danielle Jutras began us with yesterday morning so wonderfully. It's a spirit that I know you and everyone in this room so values. I am learning that sung words can be the strongest words. Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me live forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, we love you.
Thank you. And I wonder now if I can get one of those famous hugs.
And that lyrically ends a magic presentation, I think, from the most wonderful reflection of the best of Rod's mind and heart. I don't know now whether you want the break, because we've gone on.
Well, you know, it has to happen in order to break down.
Under the direction of a judge, of course. Thank you, everybody.